From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Last week, we announced some big news. KCRW and Gustavo Arellano's Great Tortilla Tournament is back for its second year. The previous year's competition was fierce, with Sonora Town beating out 63 other tortilla makers from Southern California. This week, Gustavo Arellano paid the reigning champions a visit at their downtown restaurant. He wanted to learn about their mental state going into this year's tournament and what all goes into a great Sonoran tortilla.
Hola, I'm Gustavo Arellano with Good Food, and I'm here with Jennifer Feltham of Sonora Town, checking in on 1 year after they won the inaugural KCRW and Gustavo's Great Tortilla Tournament. Hola, Jen.
Hi, Gustavo. It's so good to be with you guys today.
And so tell us, a year later after you won, how has Sonora Town's everything changed?
Everything's a good way to describe it. I always think of press as sort of like these weird sets of dominoes that like one ends up hitting the next and things just continue to get bigger. And after we won the best tortilla in Los Angeles, we actually had a really great piece of good luck where Netflix reached out to us to be in a taco documentary called The Taco Chronicles. And everything has been pretty wild over here since then. But we are weathering the storm and we're stronger than ever.
It's not just the Taco Chronicles. You got write-ups in the New York Times. Rene Redzepi came over, asked for your tortillas. All of this is happening. Did you ever expect so much attention to be put on Sonora Town because of flour tortillas?
I mean, it is what is like the foundational part of what we do. But no, did I expect all of this? Of course not. No, of course not. I didn't even know if people were going to be open to flour tortillas because when we began in 2016, we were sort of ripe in the middle of the moment of gluten-free being the latest sort of craze or problem or trend, however you want to look at it. I'm not sure. So we opened up thinking it was probably a bad idea to have that be our foundational part, but just knowing that these things were very special to us, and it was sort of a big experiment to see if it would also be special to other people.
Just remind the audience, you don't just make flour tortillas. It's a special type of flour tortilla. So describe what type of tortilla ustedes make and also how it's different from other styles of tortillas.
Oh, absolutely. So originally when we were going to start out, we looked to try and buy our flour tortillas because to make your own is a huge amount of cost, time, labor, and sourcing the ingredients. But we couldn't find any that matched the style that Tio is used to growing up with in San Luis Rio Colorado, Sonora, Mexico. The style there is thinner than most of the taco-sized tortillas you'll find here in LA, if you can find flour taco-sized tortillas, besides the mission stuff, but we're not even going to count that in. So what we do is we source the flour from Sonora because that style of flour works best with the recipe that Tio's mom gave us. We've tried other flours and the texture is wrong, the flavor is wrong. This is just what works best.
And describe that flour. What's the name and how is it different from other flours?
Sure. The name of the flour, the brand, is called Bonfil, and it's a wheat that grows in northern Mexico. The people at the mill have told me that it's an heirloom wheat that just specifically grows in northern Mexico, and that's why it's so special. But they also, it also makes a softer tortilla. So the type of tortilla that we end up is more pliable, flexible, elastic even would be something you'd say.
It's a wonderful, like stretchy, almost translucent tortilla. Did you ever expect that this tortilla would win the best tortilla for the tortilla tournament?
No, and that's amazing because sometimes you have a feeling about something that you do, you know? Like maybe you'll eat something that you made and you'll be like, wow, that's a really great thing I made. But you don't know if other people will share that same feeling. And so it's always fun to sort of share something that you've done and be like, do you also feel that this is special? And it seems like people agree that yes, it is.
What's happened in the aftermath of winning the tortilla tournament? Like, you guys doubled your space, but what else? Are people now coming up saying, hey, I never heard about flour, or I always thought flour tortillas were bad, but now hearing that you guys make good ones, I want to try it.
Absolutely, and you can almost pick those people out in the line with like a little bit of a stank face being like, well, flour tortillas are just for burritos is something I hear a lot from people who that haven't tried the food yet. I don't eat tacos with flour tortillas. And then I'll have to tell them, well, we don't offer you a choice, so if you'll try it, I'll even give it to you for free. I think you're going to like it. And almost always people do, and it's always fun to sort of explain to people that corn tortillas are a part of Mexico, but so are flour, and it's not necessarily a Tex-Mex thing. There's a long history in Sonora of making flour tortillas, and people there are very proud of what they do and their culture, and I'm happy to be able to share that with Angelinos.
You're the top seed, of course, as a champion in this year's tortilla tournament, so who do you think are some of the strong contenders this year on the flour category?
Man, I'm really excited to see the new people you brought in. I hope we don't lose it to Brutto La Palma this year, but they are excellent, and I love what they do. I'm such a huge Brutto La Palma fan, so if we lose to them, I can't wait to clasp them in a great big hug. But yeah, no, I mean, I think our flour tortillas are turning out better than they've ever. Our crew and Doña Julia, I mean, she's only getting better at what she does, and I'm so proud of what we've been able to accomplish.
We're here in the Sonora Town kitchen. They're making flour tortillas right now. I'm just going to eat one. Mmm, this is why they won. They're soft, they're a little bit salty. They're as translucent as, like, if you remember those old projectors in high school where, like, they would mark on them or whatever, that's how thin they are, but they're just absolutely amazing. And we're gonna talk with the ladies who make the tortillas right now.
Mi nombre es Julia Guerrero. Soy de Mexicali, Baja California, de Mexico. Y pues aquí hago tortillas.
We're talking with Julia Guerrero, the head tortilla maker at Sonora Town. She's been making tortillas her entire life. She was born in Mexicali. She showed us, or she's talking to us about how to make the tortillas. So they use them, they get the little ball, they put it on the press, and they put it on the grill for the small ones. But the bigger tortillas, the ones that they use for Sonora Town's chivichangas and burritos, they actually roll it. They get a pin, they roll it. They also use flour. While they're rolling it out, they'll sprinkle just a little bit of flour. Just makes it that much more stretchy and that much more of a delicious experience. It's great because when you're eating the tortilla, your fingers get a little bit white just with all the flour that they're using. And of course, she's very proud that Sonora Town won the Golden Tortilla in last year's tortilla tournament, but she doesn't take all the credit. She says it's everyone here at Sonora Town. It's a team. They're the ones who made it. And what's amazing also is just how much the business has expanded in Sonora Town. When they started, they were using 25 pounds of flour a day to make tortillas. Right now, as we speak, they're using 135 pounds of tortilla a day. That's like, I don't do the math. Was it 400, 500, a 1,000,000% increase over that time? But she's really proud about that. It's just her and another woman. They get the little balls, they roll them out, and that's how all you people who love Sonora Town, this is where the magic happens.
Okay.
El bol. El bol. Why do you think flour tortillas are now finally getting respect after years of just being dismissed as Mission and Guerrero crap?
I mean, people are putting, they're more interested in, like, regional cuisine than they've ever been. I think for a long time, Mexican food was just sort of, like, one thing. And our history has been, like, a little bit offensive and racist to the people of Mexico, not really acknowledging the, like, breadth and depth of the cooking and culture there. So I think that's what's happening. People are learning a little bit more about the different regions of Mexico and what you can expect to find style-wise. So when people say, like, this taco is authentic and this one is not, maybe they're making a more educated statement at this point as they learn more about all the different things that Mexico has to offer.
There was an episode of Netflix's The Taco Chronicles where Sonora Town played a big part. Because of that, you have one-hour lines right now. So for those people who want their taste of Sonora Town, they come up and they say, wow, that's a long line. What's your advice to them?
We have added more people to the kitchen, so the line's actually going a lot faster, even if it looks long. Right now, what used to be a two-hour line with more people in the kitchen is about 30 minutes. And, I mean, regardless of the lines, if you wait, you'll get to try something that took me maybe 6, 7, 8, 9 hours to work on and behind the scenes. And so I did all the waiting for you at this point. All you have to do is hang out here, and we'll serve you all the frescas and then serve you something that you can't find in other spots. So I think it's worth it.
And play some of the best Mexican music in Southern California.
Thank you. All those playlists, I'm really proud of them. I love bringing some of the back of the house into the front of the house here in my restaurant, making it all one instead of, and like in most restaurants we go to, and you'll find Mexican music blaring in the back of the house only. We have it all. It's the same sort of experience from front to back, and I'm really proud of that.
Gracias, Jen.
Thank you so much.
I was talking to Jennifer Feltham of Sonora Town, a winner of last year's Great Tortilla Tournament and the top seed in this year's Great Tortilla Tournament.
Sonora Town is one of 32 tortilla makers that's made it to the second round. Next Wednesday, that number becomes 16. As always, visit kcrw.com/tortilla to see who's moving on. You can also get tasting notes from each of us judges and RSVP to see the final four tortilla makers face off downtown on September 8th. It's at the LA Plaza de Cultura y Artes, and there, of course, will be tacos, games, live music, and more. It's free to all. It's great to see flour tortillas getting more love these days, but LA is still a city that runs on corn tortillas, and the best of them start with quality masa. In 2014, I spoke to Eddie De La Torre. He's the owner of Carnitas Uruapan in Boyle Heights, which makes their masa in-house. If you've tried the tortillas at Guisados, you've tasted their handiwork. His brother Armando owns Guisados, which gets its masa fresh from Eddie. So you've been making this masa for how long?
25 years now.
25 years. And was it a family recipe?
No, not really. It was more of a, my father's into real estate, purchased the building. It was previously Carnitas Uruapan, which was a restaurant slash meat market. And back at the time, my ex-father-in-law gave me the idea of putting a business like his, which was a Mexican deli as well. So we started almost emulating exactly what he does. And over the years, we just started changing to what the community needed, but always, always worked around the masa.
So when you say changed to what the community needed, it seems that so often now, a lot of Mexican communities are moving more to maseca, the flour you get in a bag, rather than going to a store and buying masa preparada.
Correct. I think because where we are located, there's such a huge Hispanic community, be it Central American, from Mexico, you know, Salvadoranian people, they all want their masa and they want it fresh. So that's why I had said, you know, we kept the base of the masa because that was so important to us to have it, you know, right there in front. That's why if you go to my market, it's right as you walk in, you can see everything being done. There's nothing behind walls or it's all right there in the open. And I think that's been a big thing that they can see the fresh corn going through the stages until they get the final product, which is the masa.
So let's talk about that process.
You know, we get the corn. We get it between, depending on the day of the week, for each vat, between 500 and 600 pounds of raw corn.
Where does the corn come from?
Most of it comes from Nebraska.
And what kind is it? It's not the kind of corn we're used to eating, is it?
No, this is a dried corn, a little bit larger than you would see like on a regular corn on the cob. And it's made, it's strictly produced for tortillas and corn chips and such. The corn gets put into the vat along with some water and some what they call food-grade hydrated lime, which is the agent that's used to peel the corn. People say to cook it. We really don't, I don't consider it cooking. I consider it steeping because the corn, the center of the kernel is actually still raw. So as it's steeped, it's only, like I said, 600 pounds. From the time we put the cold water, we fill the tank up and we turn it on for approximately 48 minutes. It's got to be right at the right point. If you have overcooked, you get a mush. You don't get a good product. The tortilla is very sticky. So when you try and press it, you lose the texture and it becomes more like a gum, a sticky, chewy gum. And you don't want that.
Is the lime alkaline?
It's a non-alkaline lime.
It's a non-alkaline lime. Because it completely transforms the corn. I mean, what we look at and we see as hominy, that's corn that's gone through this process.
It's gone through the same process, but it's cooked longer. If I leave my tanks on for 45 minutes longer than I'm supposed to, I will end up with hominy.
So after it's steeped and it's sort of released that outer coating,
it has to cool naturally, which takes approximately 12 to 16 hours.
Does it cool in the same water in which it's been steeped?
Correct. We turn it off and we leave it that way until the following day.
And then when you're ready to grind, do you drain it?
Well, then we wash it. That's why there's two vats at all times. So today's vat that was cooked this morning, tomorrow we will move it over to the left and put the other one to the right and start the process over again.
So this word called nixtamal, at what point is it no longer corn, maíz, and it's nixtamal?
Nixtamal, once it actually, I use it like a popcorn, once it pops, once you see the actual kernel pop, it is now nixtamal.
So now we're at the point where you're grinding it. Is masa always made at the same kind of grind, or choosing that grind, is that part of the way you personalize it?
We have two different grinds. We have a grind for tortilla, which is a fine grind where we'll actually torque down a little bit the stones so they're nice and tight. And it will release a fine masa, which you want for tortillas. And when we're going to make masa for tamales, then we'll leave it a little bit open so it'll actually come out coarse. So the masa will be airy, and it'll absorb the oils, And you have a great tamale.
I love your mouth is watering while you're talking about your own product. And you just said the word stone. So that means this is stone ground.
Yes, ma'am. It goes through a stone grinder.
So interesting. Okay, so now you have the Nix tamal, and it's been turned into, is it masa yet? Once it's ground, it's called
masa. Once it's ground, it now comes out masa, correct.
And what can you do with it then without adding anything else?
You make tortillas. You can make sopes. Central American people, as I said, they use that masa, the actual finely ground masa, for their tamales.
Okay, so I just want to talk about the experience of eating these tortillas. I had never tasted a tortilla when I ate at Guisados that had that particular texture before.
To me, I think a lot to do with that is the way they're pressed. Armando, because he's serving a guisado on a taco, he has to press them a little bit thicker so they'll withstand the moisture and the actual stew that's in the taco. If not, they will just become soggy and you won't enjoy them. So I think the magic to that is the press he uses, and he presses just with the right texture so it cooks through. You don't want to turn it over and turn it over and turn it over. You want to turn it over the first time. When you see the different color changing on the tortilla, the skin, then you'll just give it one flip and you leave it like that, and it's going to balloon. You know the inside's cooked and you're all ready to go.
So today you brought me a bag of masa preparada.
No, that's masa for tortillas.
Oh, this is masa for tortillas.
Yes.
Okay, what's the difference between masa preparada and masa for tortillas?
The word preparado would mean prepared. So it's masa preparada para tamales. We grind it not as fine. It's more, it comes out porous. It comes out more whole. It goes into the mixers along with the oil. We have three different recipes actually for our prepared masa. We have masa with a mixture of lard and vegetable shortening. We have one that's all vegetable shortening, and we have one that we do with canola oil.
And what do you use in your family?
I have vegetable shortening for my family. I made it for my father. That's where we started the recipe, and it came out quite good, so we continue using that. Every year, my mom uses that for our tamales.
Eddie De La Torre's store is called Carnitas Uruapan. It's in Boyle Heights. We've been talking about masa, how it's made, and what to do with it. After the break, we turn from tortillas to another kind of food we Angelenos are very familiar with. We're talking about Korean home cooking with author Sohee Kim after the break. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman.
Kimchi is like the king. If you don't have kimchi on the Korean table, then it's not really a meal, my father used to say. And now that I'm getting older, I totally agree with that.
When you're introduced to a cuisine by eating in restaurants, oftentimes the process and the pantry seem impenetrable. But Chef Sohee Kim likens Korean home cooking to that of Southern Italy. She says there are just a few ingredients that are combined in slightly different ways with a knowing hand. Her book, Korean Home Cooking, aims to give us the confidence to develop our own familiarity with the cuisine so we can make it our own. Hi.
Hello.
What a wonderful book this is.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm pretty happy about it, especially the beautiful photographs.
Yeah, the photographs are incredible. And I don't know if it's your voice, but, you know, I see a lot of cookbooks about cuisines that I don't feel very comfortable making at home. And I have to say, I think yours might be the first one that actually brings me into the kitchen for making Korean food.
Oh, that's so great. Great to hear.
One of the things that I find every time I'm trying to familiarize myself with a cuisine is, yeah, sure, I need to go out and buy a new pantry of ingredients, but I also need to teach myself all the culinary gestures that are repeated over and over that for you are just an innate rhythm, but for me, make me feel like I'm tripping over my feet. So first, let's talk pantry. What are the essential ingredients that we need to have?
Sure. So I like to call them sort of the Korean mother sauces that all Korean pantries should have. And so that starts with the gochujang, which is the Korean spicy chili paste. And then there's also gochugaru, gochu meaning pepper, chili pepper in Korean. Gochugaru, garu means flakes or powder. And that's essential in making kimchi, for instance. And there's also the big mother sauce of doenjang, which is the soybean paste, is fermented soybean paste. And that sort of is the equivalent of what miso is in Japanese cuisine. And of course, you have the soy sauce that is traditionally brewed, as well as, you know, smaller sort of players like rice wine vinegar, sesame seed, sesame oil. But I feel like, you know, in modern day pantry, you know, you could find those little players in there. So I think the major three things that start the Korean pantry would be the gochugaru, the chili flakes, the gochujang, which is the paste, and then doenjang, which is the soybean paste.
You start the recipe section of the book with banchan, which makes a lot of sense. Can you explain what it is for people who maybe haven't yet gone to a Korean restaurant, which is kind of inexplicable to me?
Sure. So banchan is basically, it means side dishes. And it's all the little morsels of taste that you get when you go to a Korean restaurant. Some Korean restaurants that are geared toward more traditional cooking, where they feature, you know, soups and stews, they give you more of the banchan. And it's sort of, quote unquote, free on the house. And it's sort of a showcase of what the cook or the chef is able to do or what they want to show off. And in a home cooking sense, it is what you put out for, you know, super duper amazing guests. So if we're just having simple dinner at home, you know, family of four or six, then you might just have, say, kimchi, which is the, you know, pickled cabbage, and, you know, maybe three other things. But if you have guests over, coming over for dinner, then you might want to up that number to like 7 or 9. So, you know, they have this little saying in Korea that if you, you kind of know what kind of a special guest you are when you go over to someone's house by the number of banchan that they put out for you.
Oh, that's really scary.
Yeah.
It's a really incredible chapter. And there are so many things I know I'm going to make, like the lotus root. I'm kind of obsessed with the crunch of lotus root. But the charred eggplant with white soy and chili seems to me perfect for summer. I mean, people are using their grills anyway. But I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
First of all, what is white soy?
White soy is a brewed soy sauce, but it's just done differently. It's not, so soy sauce, the brown stuff, really is a byproduct of when you make doenjang. When you make doenjang, that's the soybean paste that I was speaking of earlier. And white soy doesn't have the caramel coloring. So it has a lighter flavor, and obviously it really is for the color or lack thereof that I use it. Because when you have beautiful, you know, Asian variety eggplant that you could see all over the place in summer markets, I don't necessarily want to make it too brown. So I use white soy instead. And it's easy to find these days in markets. But obviously, if you cannot find it, then regular soy sauce is a fine substitute.
And it's so interesting that given the amount of salt used in Korean food to ferment and to sort of act as a cleaning agent that's then rinsed off, it's so interesting to me with this eggplant dish that you don't salt it first.
Right. We treat it very differently from, say, the Italian eggplant, which, you know, sort of the whatever recipe you're making, I'm always used to sort of salting it and then letting it sit, exude water. I don't find that challenge with Japanese eggplants or Asian eggplants at all.
So let's talk about kimchi. There's so much in that chapter. I have to say the first thing I'm going to make is the stuffed cucumber.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorites. Because it's simple. It's not super challenging and hard.
Could you describe it?
Absolutely. So again, you know, peak season in the summertime when you get these beautiful small-sized cucumbers. Kirby's are generally what we use in Korea, but I've made that recipe with Persian cucumbers as well, just adjusting the salt a little bit here and there. But basically, you have these mini cucumbers. Let's see, you sort of crisscross slice it, but you don't let it all sort of fall apart, so you keep it whole on one end. You salt it sort of on the outside, and then you stuff it with this beautiful mixture of chili flakes, garlic chives, scallions, whatever you really want to put into it, some carrots for color, and then you just let it sit a couple of days. And so it's sort of a quick pickle and not like, you know, it's not pickled in brine, basically. And it's crunchy. It's not overly salty, but it has amazing flavor inside. And it actually is a specialty. It's a summer recipe. I like to think of it as a summer recipe. And you just mentioned the white kimchi broth. Some noodles tossed with the white kimchi broth, like say some like somen or soba, with a side of that pickled stuffed cucumber. To me, that's the simplest, most amazing summer Korean meal you can have.
So I want to go back and ask you another question about banchan. You mentioned that if you're eating at home, if it's a family meal, it's super simple and maybe there are three things. So what would those three things have most likely been in your family?
Oh, definitely kimchi. Kimchi is like the king. If you don't have kimchi on the Korean table, then it's not really a meal, my father used to say. And now that I'm getting older, I totally agree with that. So kimchi is king. And then my household, I like to make the black soybeans. I have a great recipe in the book for that. And it's basically soy pickled soybeans. It has a good amount of sugar in it, good amount of delicious soy. And it keeps. So I make a batch of that on Sunday, say, and we eat it throughout the week. So that's always a staple. My daughter loves the chewy cuttlefish or the squid banchan, where you could go to the market and they actually have these beautiful sort of sliced and shaved squid. They look like string, basically. And you just have to marinate it with a little spices like gochujang, gochugaru, some garlic, some sesame oil, and she loves it. It's like time release flavor. The more you chew on the squid, you know, the better it is. And I like to play off colors, some textures, some pickled items. If you have a pickle item, then I like to have, you know, something that's like the beans or the squid. And definitely there's always a sort of plain-ish vegetable, say watercress or spinach, simply steamed, squeezed out, and then just tossed with a little sesame oil, some white soy or soy, some garlic, and that would make the foundation for a perfect simple banchan layout.
Let's talk about the gochujang glazed baby back ribs, because they sound easy and summery. And I think it's a sort of easy way for people to get used to what gochujang is.
That's actually a perfect recipe to introduce people to Korean food and make it sort of not too challenging. Gochujang, to me, it's basically hot sauce paste, and it makes a great foundation for barbecue sauce. And so no matter how people work their grill in the summertime, you know, baby back ribs, St. Louis ribs, whatever ribs, you know, they could par-cook it, par-boil it, whatever they do, it inevitably has to end up on the grill, right? And all you have to do is make the sauce and just sort of baste it as you're grilling it, just like you would any other jar of, you know, fantastic barbecue sauce. So it gives it, obviously, a little bit of a kick. But in terms of a glaze, the way that it goes on very thickly on the ribs, it grills up beautifully. So you have like a thin layer of sauce, and then you bite into the charred, you know, ribs, and it's perfection in the summertime. In fact, I make that almost every other week for my children. It's one of their favorites.
So let's talk about spam. It's used it's used throughout Asia, and it's used in Korean, a really famous stew.
Mm-hmm.
You have a recipe for the spam itself in the book, like making the actual spam, not just a recipe using it. It really is just like a tureen, right?
Basically, it is a tureen. So when we set out to make up the menu for INSA. Because we're in a neighborhood of Brooklyn that does not, is not supported by a huge Korean, you know, immigrant population, I knew that we were going to make a restaurant for people, maybe 50% of the people who walk in might not know what Korean cuisine is. So we were very careful to sort of make sure that we have some safe bets that people could go go to. But then we also, I also wanted to challenge the people who come in. Obviously, spam isn't challenging necessarily in terms of the imagination, but I wanted to take, obviously, this ubiquitous canned potted meat and try to make it ourselves, you know, without all the preservatives and stuff. And this is not knocking Hormel spam. I, you know, definitely, you know, they have a history and people are totally hooked on to the taste of it, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's delicious. And once we sort of tried to dissect the dish, it just was a basically charcuterie 101. So you take the best cuts of meats and you just sort of pot it and you steam it, you flavor it, and make sure that it's bound enough so that you could have clean slices. And I think that we came up with the perfect recipe. So whether or not I included that in the book, you know, my editor and I talked about that. It's like, oh, this is, no one's going to make spam at home. But if you had, you know, 48 hours and you wanted to challenge yourself, you know, the recipe is there. Likewise for the blood sausage as well. You know, obviously it's two levels up in terms of cooking level, but it is there for you. And once you sort of break it down, it's not as complicated as you think it is. So people who are into making charcuterie, homemade sausages, stuff like that, you know, they wouldn't find it too challenging. But so delicious.
Thank you so much, Sohee. I mean, it's really a fantastic book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
I've been talking with Sohee Kim, chef and owner of The Good Fork and INSA restaurants in Brooklyn. Her book is Korean Home Cooking. Visit kcrw.com/goodfood for a recipe. Coming up, we continue our focus on the home kitchen. How can we improve on the classics? After the break, a visit from Jet and Ali Tila. That's when Good Food returns. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
I am so, like, not ashamed at all for being... You could peg me as the Asian dude in food. I'm super happy. Like, orange chicken, drunken noodles, pad thai have all been, like, integral parts of my career.
Jet Tila has been a friend of Good Food as long as we can remember. He's a native Angeleno, and his parents still operate a store that was the first Thai market in this city. These days, he's recognized by millions as a presenter on Iron Chef America. But cooking well and teaching others how to do it is still a passion of his. Today, I'm joined by Jet and his wife and partner, Ali. The duo called Team Tila has written a guide to learn technique through classic dishes. It's called 101 Epic Dishes.
Wow. Evan, we have known each other.
Team Tila.
Team Tila.
Team Tila.
I feel like we've been doing this since we were babies.
You're not kidding. I was thinking about it. I think we've known each other since 1999. Evan, when I was teaching at New School.
Oh, yeah.
And they were underwrote your show, and I was like, I'm such a fan of Evan. And then I got
Jet
to meet you, and
me
I was
that
freaking
all the time,
out.
And he still does.
So what really intrigues me about the two of you is how Ali, at a certain point during your trajectory, stepped in and said, I can do this better than the people that were doing it or the people that we were getting advice from. I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so you sort of stepped in and started booking and creating opportunity.
Right. I spent 15 years working for the Los Angeles Unified School District as a special education teacher. So I love that time and I learned so much. And, you know, working with kids and families is wonderful. But after our daughter was born, I decided to, you know, start working with Jet full time in the business. And, you know, I started with the accounting and the booking and, you know, kind of the business end of it. And that just kind of morphed into other things. So, you know, I would help him create content. And I had dabbled kind of in, you know, video editing with my dog. So I would train my border collie and do little
videos. Yeah, your obsessive fetching dog.
Yes, you know her, Rogue. And so I would then edit his online content in the beginning. And, you know, it was really fun. So just doing whatever needed to be done.
But then at a certain point, you started to focus on baking.
Right. I've always loved baking and pastry. It's kind of just always been a passion of mine. When I was little, I had this Mickey Mouse cookbook, and I'd be like 8 years old. You know, my mom worked long hours, and she was a single mom. So I'd be at home 8 years old making custards, you know, in the oven from this, you know, water bath, you know, from this Mickey Mouse cookbook, you know. So Jet at one point said, you should just go to pastry school. And I said, that's a genius idea. I love that. And so I did. And I kind of stepped more into the cooking side of Team Tila.
So let's talk about this new book, 101 Epic Dishes, by the two of you. So this isn't a Thai cookbook.
No, it's actually, there's only like four or five Asian recipes. It's really a book from two teachers, right? Ali, a 15-year teacher. I've been teaching, gosh, for about 20 years. And, you know, it might feel like basic recipes, but as cooks, we really feel like you need to understand technique and you need to master the basics to be a better cook. And these are recipes we cook every single day. And I think with every recipe, there's a key technique. So Ali has a fancy word for because she went to school for teaching and special ed and all that good stuff. So what is that word? What's
scaffolding. You want to scaffold the learning. So, you know, we went kind of back and forth. What would be the best way to teach people cooking? You know, I mean, people learn so many different ways, different modalities. For example, like you're a visual learner or you're an auditory or, you know, you're better learning hands-on. And so, you know, we decided we want to teach them the foundations of cooking so that you're not just teaching them, oh, to cook one recipe. You're teaching them a technique so that they can cook 10 recipes.
And I have to say what I love about this collection of recipes is that the recipes are simple and approachable mm-hmm. and stuff we all love to eat
right.
on a daily basis. But in the head notes, you point out what the lesson is to be learned.
Right.
It's like, this is what you're going to learn. And what I like about that is it just like, oh, yeah, I'll pay attention to that while I'm making this recipe.
That's it. I think it really is for people who either already are good cooks and want to really kind of nail down certain techniques. And it's phenomenal for like, I really know a lot about food, but I haven't really cooked. Because, you know, in this generation, everybody watches these short little videos online or they read little clippets and they think they understand things, right? But until you actually, like, get that tactile feel and cook
yeah,
things.
Yeah, it's about repetition with your hands.
Totally, right? And it's how the mind and hands work together, right?
Right, along with your nose.
And along with your nose.
Yeah, I just think cooking is, like, the best example of being physically present.
Wow.
I love that.
That's heavy.
I love
that. It's like cooking meditation because you have to be aware
for
a lot of us.
For me, it is because I know enough that I'm not worried most of the time as I'm cooking. But but I do think that it's people think of it as being arduous. And no, it's just a moment to pause
right,
and enjoy.
Yeah. And that's our technique. It's like, relax. Like our whole feel of this book is like, just chill out. It's just cooking. Let's just take one thing, like roasting, and let's just roast something and make it delicious. And we even start with our cooking dogma. Like, brown food tastes good. You know what I mean? Like, and there's two types of cooking. It all breaks down to either moist or dry, and just relax. You're going to be okay.
So I'm just going to pick some recipes. So it's summer.
Mm.
Corn.
Yes.
Fresh sweet corn pudding.
Oh, man.
Yum.
This is the best time, isn't it? Like, super sweet. It involves a little bit of custardy action, right? So, and it's one of those dishes you can bring to, like, a summer potluck. It's a family dish. And it's also a dish in our minds where it really accentuates the corn. But now I'm like, I want people to understand, like, I could take this corn pudding to a potluck. I could probably serve it for a dinner. And then if you take it into another season, pair it with like our prime rib or roast chicken to create really meals. So these recipes should all work together to create different meals.
So to me, the hardest part of this particular recipe is cutting the corn off the cob.
Right.
So you actually have this great little section in the front of the book about knives and about how don't get seduced.
Mm-hmm. Do not.
Don't go on to one of those Japanese knife sites online when you're buying your first knife.
I actually say that. Don't buy blocks. Like, don't buy sets. Don't buy blocks. Like, start with a chef's knife, right? And in my mind, like, every chef has their own way to do it. I think you need a chef. So you need a serrated, like a 9-inch, because that'll be a bread knife that can cut really soft things. And if you want to get crazy, no one really cuts meat anymore. But if you want to get crazy, either a paring or a fillet for me. And then if you want to shuck corn, put one little bowl inverted over one big bowl. And then you can actually have a little rest. When you slice through the corn, you can get to the bottom of that cob without, like, hitting the edge of the bowl. So, again, like, we weave in a lot of, like, little tips and tricks like that.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. I have to say, what I love about this recipe is that the facing recipe is one of my favorite recipes of all time, that when I go out to certain restaurants in town, like Moussin Frank's or Lowry's, mm-hmm. I will order the cream spinach with bacon.
Kind of,
yeah.
You see how it's like Inception. There's so many layers. We're trying to penetrate your mind in so many layers under the guise of this. Oh, it's a simple little cookbook, but it's not.
But what I love about that recipe is that you call for frozen spinach, and I have to say that this is what I love about what you do, mm-hmm. is that there's no pretension. Mm. This is about being a regular person getting it done.
That's it. We all aspire to be foodies. Some of us hate that word. But man, like 90% of people just want to cook better and not want to feel intimidated by things. And that's exactly how Ali and I are. We know our audience and we love our audience. You know what I mean? The people who watch Food Network are phenomenal working people that just right. want to cook food, and they have families and they have jobs and they just want to have a good time and not overthink things, you know?
Right, right. We are definitely lacking in pretension on TV.
Maybe we need to get more snobby.
No, please don't. So you have two children.
Yes.
Are they your tasting team?
They are absolutely brutal tasters, which is what I love about them. I made an ice cream cake for Jet's birthday this year, and I didn't have a lot of time. I made an American buttercream for the top, and Amaya was like, "Mom, I didn't like the frosting on the top." And I'm like, "I know." She's honest, which is the best.
Does she cook with you?
They both do.
Amaya's got some wicked knife skills already.
And piping skills, too.
So there is a quite adorable photograph in the book of the two of them consuming strawberry balsamic creamsicle pops.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us about those yummy pops, Ali.
Oh, I love these. You puree the strawberries, throw in the simple syrup, balsamic, a little lemon, puree the mint leaves in, and then fill the mold, I don't know, 3/4 of the way. And then I sweeten heavy cream and pour it around the edges so that it kind of swirls in. You can mix it a little just so that you can see the swirl a little bit better on the sides. And I like to stick some sliced strawberries on the side as decoration.
So, Jet, I hate to bring this up because I don't want to peg you as like a one-dish guy, but you have this recipe for orange chicken.
I am so like not ashamed at all for being, you could peg me as the Asian dude in food. I'm super happy. Like orange chicken, drunken noodles, pad thai have all been like integral parts of my career. Everyone loves to eat it, if you can admit it or not. And those of you, shame on you if you secretly enjoy it but won't admit it. And there's no really great recipes. And, you know, we all know the restaurant that made it famous, but I actually got to like sit with the chef. You know what I mean? Who created this kind of iconic global dish.
Me too. It's right? amazing. I mean, yeah, I once judged an orange chicken competition down in Chinatown.
I remember that.
Evan Kleinman.
I remember that.
And there were, you know, all these other chefs that were putting their stamp on the orange chicken. And mm-hmm. it was just, okay.
Yeah, yeah, right? And then when he does it, when chef does it, so I got to sit with him and like, I got to like extract, you know what I mean? Some really key information from him. So why not share that? And I asked him, I'm like, look, I've never seen your written recipe. This is kind of what I've, gleaned from our conversations. And, you know, he signs off on it. It's a phenomenal recipe. But within that, it teaches you like proper, like, you know, dredging. It talks about tempura flour, right? So again, there's a lot of these little tips that you can apply to just about anything. Because if you can make a delicious orange chicken, you could do General So's, you could bring that on to, you know, lemon. And so, yeah, I think it is a foundational recipe in Chinese American cuisine. And why not learn how to make it from scratch?
Of course. Well, I want to thank the two of you, Jet and Ali, for coming by, as always, being a teacher.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Thank you for
Take
having
care.
Us.
Thank you. That's Chef Jet Tila and his wife, Ali. They're the duo behind 101 Epic Dishes, recipes that teach you how to make the classics even more delicious. After the break, the market report. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Now we turn it over to Jillian Ferguson, who's at the farmer's market.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. We're back in Santa Monica this week, standing at Alex Weiser's farm stand, and there are a bunch of chefs gathered around a certain small orangish pepper. And one of those chefs is Justin Abram, chef de cuisine at Calabra, which is the rooftop restaurant at the Proper Hotel on 7th and Wilshire. Justin, tell us a little bit about these peppers. What are they called?
Hey, thank you for having me. These are called Biquinho peppers from Weiser Farms. These little baby sweet peppers, they have like this taste of a habanero, but with no spice at all.
Yeah, it's really surprising. They're so small. I always think of the smallest peppers as being the spiciest peppers, but these actually don't have much spice.
Yeah, no, not these. These are just these little baby cute peppers, you know, with no spice, and they're just nice and sweet.
And really brightly colored. So what are you going to do with them when you get back to the restaurant?
So these, I'm thinking of putting a new dish on and stewing these down with some garlic and shallots, a little bit of harissa, and some tomato sauce. And just stew it all down and serve it with a little bit of feta cheese, and then serve it with some grilled laffa bread, which is almost a between a naan and a pita bread. And that'll be part of like our dips.
Ah, it's a dip.
Yeah.
Okay.
A little dip.
And then what does the pepper bring to this dish? If it's not bringing the heat, like what are you looking for from the flavor of this pepper?
So it's giving that spiciness. I mean, I'm putting some harissa in it, but it also gives you that flavor where you'll find in a jalapeno or habanero, but with none of that spice, which is great. You know, you still get that fruity flavor from this little pepper.
So tell us a little bit more about the menu at the restaurant. Is it mostly Mediterranean?
Yes. So we've been open for 1 month, super Mediterranean, but using these California ingredients. You know, we're 5 blocks away. I get to just walk here, pick everything out, and bring it back. And especially that's on a rooftop, you want that Mediterranean feel, like looking at the ocean.
And is it the only restaurant in the Proper Hotel?
No, we have 3 restaurants.
Wow.
The rooftop restaurant, which is called Calabra. We have our lobby lounge, which is called Palma. And then within the next month or two, we have Onda opening up, which is going to be Jessica Coslow's.
Oh, right. Jessica Coslow and Gabby Kamara.
Yes.
Well, great. Sounds like a place that we want to hang out and eat.
Thank you. Yeah, this is great.
That was Justin Abram, chef de cuisine at Calabra, the brand new rooftop restaurant at the Proper Hotel on 7th and Wilshire. We're talking now with Alex Weiser, who's growing these Biquinho peppers. And Alex, how did you find out about these?
Well, my sister, actually, she found the seed and suggested we grow them because earlier in the year we had Chef Rodrigo Guzman from Brazil come to our farm and got familiar with Brazilian cuisine. And my sister said, hey, this is a beautiful Biquinho pepper from Brazil. We should grow it. And it sounds great. And it is. It's a fruity pepper. It looks like a little teardrop, kind of. It's fruity and it has just a little heat.
Yeah, Justin mentioned that there wasn't much heat to it, but I just ate one over at your stand, and there is a little bit of spice to it.
It's sneaky. It develops a little later, and it just kind of tastes the fruitiness at first and that pepper flavor, and then you go, oh, yes, and then the heat comes a little later. A lot of people are pickling them and doing neat things with them. I'm just learning.
Yeah, when I got to the market today, it felt like your peppers were sort of the talk of the town.
I love that. I love that. And it's melon season, so it's neat when the peppers are getting some attention.
Yeah. Seeing the melons, that's right. And we keep talking about the Biquinho peppers, and it sounds like we're saying Biquinho, I think, but it's spelled with a B.
It's spelled B-I-Q-U-I-N-H-O, Biquinho.
Is that a Portuguese word?
I believe so, and it means little beak.
Ah, okay.
So they're also known as little beak peppers.
And how long do you think you'll have them?
I think till frost. I did make 2 plantings, so we have our first planting in now. I think we'll have them through November. And I'm not sure yet, too, because I'm just first year growing them, where everything is learning. They may be even a nice dry pepper, too. So we may extend the season by drying some of them.
Okay, all right. And peppers need a lot of heat to grow, so it's been sort of a cooler year this year. Has that...
You know what? It's been perfect for peppers, because a lot of times our peppers, we lose a lot to sunburning. Not this year. So it's been a good pepper year. So even though it has been as hot, it's still 90 degrees out there.
Mm-hmm. And you're growing these in Tehachapi?
We're growing them in Lucerne Valley and down the hill from Tehachapi near Bakersfield, just below Tehachapi. So we have them in 2 spots. That's why we have a long we'll have a long season.
Okay. And then what? I saw there are a couple other peppers on your table right now. Some Calabrian peppers?
We have Calabrian peppers, fresh Calabrians that dry beautifully and pickle beautifully and stuff beautifully. We have a shishito pepper that's 1 in 10 is hot. And we have a red shishito, ripe shishitos that are really amazing. We have Cubanelle pepper, or Italian frying pepper, that looks like an Anaheim pepper, but it is no heat. And which I am learning that in Cuban cuisine and Italian cuisine, they don't like the heat as much in their peppers. So it's the basis of a lot of their pepper dishes, is that Cubanelle. And I have one more coming out that's a little later that I'm really excited about, Ají Amarillo from Peru, which is often used in ceviches and kind of a sunshiny taste to them.
A yellow pepper, right?
They're called Ají Amarillo, meaning yellow, but they ripen to orange. You know, they should call them Ají Naranja, but they're Ají Amarillo.
All right. Wow. Learning so much about peppers. Alex, yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Alex Weiser of Weiser Family Farms. You can find his peppers at many Southern California markets. They'll be here all summer long into the fall. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Finally, we close with a new restaurant review from Gustavo Arellano. He's been filling in for LA Times restaurant critic Patricia Escarcega, who's on maternity leave. Hi, Gustavo.
Hola, Evan.
So, who is the man behind Le Mirage Pastry?
So Le Mirage Pastry is in Little Arabia in Anaheim, which we've talked about many times on this show. The owner is a Syrian immigrant named Maher Nakal. And Maher opened up Le Mirage in 2005, always loved his baklava, his Middle Eastern pastries. We'll talk about some of my favorite in a bit. But early last year, he decided he was going to bring over the most famous ice cream in the Middle East, this ice cream called Bouza. And Bouza, the people who make it most famous is this stall in Damascus, in one of these their big souks that's been around for 150 years called Bakram. So he said, or Bakhtash, sorry. So he thought to himself, well, I want to bring over something from Syria that no one else knows. Like, you know, Syria's not exactly getting the best reputation right now in the American media, so I want to give people a part of my culture. So he brings over this Bouza. I get a hold of it or a wind of it, and I go in there and I'm like, this is one of the most unique ice creams I've ever had, not just because of the taste, but also how they make it.
Okay, so first, let's talk about the texture.
Bouza, it's like a mix between a marshmallow and a taffy. Like, you could stretch it out.
It's stretchy.
You've never seen ice cream that stretches. Ice cream melts, usually. And not only that, the way they make it, like, I won't tell the whole process just yet, but ultimately, when they make it, the end product, they roll it up like those disgusting old cheese logs that you could buy in the mall back in the day.
So these are like logs of stretchy ice cream with
pistachio.
Started with pistachios.
Yeah.
It's made with this unique flavor called salem.
Salem, yeah. So salem is a little bit like a mix between licorice and anise. And salem is also the root for mastic. So the reason it gets stretchy is because of mastic, which I don't even know what mastic was other than it's stretchy.
It's the original gum.
There it is. Yeah, masticar in Spanish, masticar is to chew. So that makes a lot of sense. So you get this combination. All it is like the mastic, they put in your milk. They roll this up into a log with pistachios. They add more pistachios. They put some rose water in it. And the great thing about Bouza is that you could put it outside. It's not going to melt. It's going to keep its coldness. So you could eat it in the broiling sun and you get the anise flavor. And that's all it is. The flavor really just gets to it. But that's not even the best part about it.
Okay, so let's talk about the best part, which is how it's made. Now, a regular ice cream machine, whether it's gelato or American ice cream, if you're talking about an industrial machine, you make your base, you pour it in one end, you flip the switch. It works. You open the chute at the other end and it pours out.
Yeah.
That is not what's happening here.
No. So the way to make Bouza, and they make it to, well, they make a batch every day, but you make what's going to be the Bouza. So you pour in your milk, you like mix it around, then you get an ice cold tub. Maher, he brought a machine from Syria that he didn't use for 8 months because they couldn't convert it. They couldn't convert the electricity, but it's ice cold. Then he starts pouring it inside the ice cold tub, like a sub-zero. He starts scraping it up. First, it's on the bottom. Then it's all on the side. Then it congeals.
Kind of like a cotton candy machine.
Exactly.
Except that it's super, super cold.
Super, super cold.
And so as the substance congeals on the sides, he scrapes it down.
He scrapes it up. Once it's all congealed on the side, then he makes it into one big pile. He puts it on the bottom. And then comes the fun. he gets this massive mallet, like literally a mallet that you have to hold with both hands, and then you start pounding on it.
Yes, so it's a pestle.
It's a pestle, yes. That's what you call it in English. It's this humongous, but it's not just some small pestle that you have with one hand.
This whole process reminds me so much of how they make mochi in Japan during the mochi festival. When you see these guys swinging mallets, in that case, over these masses of really sticky rice to break it down. So this muscly guy...
Oh, my God. Yeah. You see Maher's forearms. You think he could be a welterweight champion or something. And it's funny because in Syria, in Damascus, at Bakdash, the original place, it's all young, early 20-some, strapping young bucks, just boom, 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 boom. And you're thinking, how is this ice cream?
That's what causes the stretching, right?
Yeah. And it gets stretchier and stretchier. Then he gets it to a certain consistency. And then that's when he rolls it into the pistachios. Keep some, put some in the freezer, and whatever he needs to serve, that's he puts in this nice cup, even makes it look like a rose petal. And
I love that you quote him in your article saying that the neighborhood comes to taste a memory.
Yeah. His big fans are Syrians. Syrians come from all over Southern California because this is one of the few places in the United States that even tries to serve buza. As far as I could tell, it's the only place that makes it the traditional way because it's hard to do. And it's a great flavor. The pistachios especially. He gets specific Turkish pistachios that he says they're seasonal. So the season's only about 3 months worth. So he just spends a lot of money and just keeps them so he could use them year round. We always forget when we're talking about Middle Eastern flavors, it's in the Mediterranean, it's also a desert region, but yet all we ever think about is like the kibbehs, the shish kebabs, the really hearty food. And then when it comes to desserts, we think of the baklava, the kanafe, which they sell there as well. We never think, hey, maybe they might like ice cream. And so for them, this is like, oh my God, this is the ice cream that we used to have back when we used to go to Syria.
I understand that he's considering making different flavors, though, to appeal to a larger audience.
It's Anaheim. Anaheim's as diverse and multicultural an area as they get. So his Latino clients and his Filipino clients, they like it, but they say, hey, maybe you can make a mango flavor. Maybe you can make a ube flavor. And he's talking about these
things. Oh, that would be incredible.
Ube, buza, oh, that would Anaheim.
That would be insane. First of all, the color would be just extraordinary. This was such a wonderful story. Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Gracias.
That was LA Times writer Gustavo Arellano talking about Le Mirage pastry in Anaheim. Well, that's it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, as always, you can listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And as always, please leave us a review if you liked what you heard. My thanks go out to the Good Food team. They are Nick Liao, Laryl Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Paolo Lombardo. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.